Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this episode is all about lobopodians. We've got two interviews for the price of one today. First up, we have Dr. Martin Smith from the University of Cambridge discussing his reinterpretation of the world-famous Burgess Shale stem group Onychophoran hallucigenia. Martin has revisited this enigmatic fossil, which was famously reconstructed upside down and is now shown to also have been back to front too. We'll be hearing about the observations, including some new anatomical characters, that put an end to the uncertainty of the orientation of this animal. Secondly, we've got Dr. Javier Ortega-Hernandez, also from Cambridge, with an exclusive interview on a new lobopodian from the early Cambrian of China. This new genus is like a super armoured version of hallucigenia, and also has quite a surprising feeding strategy. Both of these fossils have significance for our understanding of the evolution of the larger groups to which they belong, so now is a really good time to get interested in lobopodians. This is a pretty complex interview when it comes to some of the groups we discuss. We've got lobopodians, onychophorans, stem group onychophorans, and ecdysozoans. So if you get stuck, like I did in the interview, head over to the website where we've got a bit more detail on these, along with our usual images and videos which accompany this episode. The paper in which this new genus is described and this podcast are both being released at exactly the same time, so you're hearing about this new discovery here on PaleoCast first. If you are an academic and have some new research coming out, this is a great way of spreading news of your work. You, or anyone, can get in touch with us at info@paleocast.com. We'd love to hear what you make of the show, or if you have any comments or episode recommendations, please do get in touch. But for now, I hope you enjoy this episode. So, Martin, Javier, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Right, as we always do in every single interview, we want to get to know the paleontologist and get to know how you got into the subject. So, could you give us an introduction to yourselves and tell us how you became involved in paleontology? Martin first.
I guess I'm a relatively late arriver. I feel a bit guilty that I haven't loved dinosaurs since I was four or something. But I think whilst I was at university, I just realised that all of the big unanswered questions seem to be in paleontology. And yeah, sure, you can make a big discovery in physics if you're part of a team of 100 geniuses. But I just love the idea that there were just unknown things that it seemed like I could get my head around. So that really gave me the bug, I guess.
And Javier, for you, growing up in Mexico, how did you get into paleontology as well?
Well, you'd be surprised to find out that we also have books in Mexico.
Really?
We do, indeed. I guess I'm on the opposite end, because I was one of those kids that at 4 years old, like, oh, I like dinosaurs, and I like kind of like these sort of books because they were kind of like cool beasts and whatnot. But then it was kind of much later on until kind of I came across kind of Gould's Wonderful Life, which is the most cliched thing to do as a Cambrian worker, that I kind of really went like, okay, this is what I really, really want to do. And then it just kind of rolled up from there. But I always had this interest in paleontology.
So we're talking about lobopodians today. Could you give us an introduction to what lobopodians actually are?
So lobopodians are a group of very weird-looking fossils that are only really found in the Cambrian period, and they tend to look a bit like worms, and they've got stubby little legs along each side, and some of them have got spines, some of them have got weird appendagey things at the front, and evolutionarily speaking, they're sort of the stock from which many of the modern animal groups that are more familiar today evolve from. So things like the arthropods, butterflies and shrimp and so on, as well as the rainforest-dwelling velvet worms and a group of microscopic animals called tardigrades that live in moss and that sort of thing. So there are living descendants, but nothing alive today that looks super close to a Cambrian lobopodian.
can I elaborate a little bit? You will know how to treat this, but for example, if there is something that we slightly disagree in, it's just like a technicality. It's nothing really important. But I mean, I don't want to like come across like, oh no, I'm going to.
Go on, correct me, Javier. Put me in my place. I guess some people would say that Arnie Coffrins were Labour paragons, wouldn't they?
Oh no, you're crossing my heart now.
Oh.
What I was going to say is that, most Labourpodians are known from the Cambrian, but there is some recent research. For example, we know there are Labourpodians in the Ordovician, Fesuata, Biota. They haven't been described in detail, but at least there seems to be something with spiny bits, which would look very familiar for us now.
That's true. And I think there's carbotubulus as well in the Carboniferous, isn't there? So yeah. much later. But I think it's fair to say they have their heyday in the Cambrian, do you think?
Yeah, that is pretty fair. Although, it's something worth considering that maybe there is a little bit of a preservation bias. Because after the Ordovician, we don't get these kind of British shell type deposits anymore. It could be their extinction, but also it could be a big preservation issue. But as far as we know, yeah, Cambrian is the place to look for Labourpodians.
The Labourpodians that we have today, the velvet worms, how do they live? What's their ecology?
If you include velvet worms in the Labourpodians.
Was that a bit of a Labourpodian faux pas?
Oh, yeah, it is. I'm deeply offended now. The name Labourpodia came from a mechanical description of the limbs because they are not arthropodized. They have a Labourpodus-like morphology, which is, they're kind of like soft and squishy. And then by a number of systematic kind of intricacies, the name kind of caught on and there was this suggestion, this group Labourpodia, but actually saying Labourpodian is like saying fish. It doesn't mean anything in terms of phylogeny. It's just kind of a random group of, it's not random, but it's a group of things that look superficially similar, but are not necessarily monophyletic. And indeed, some people may call Onychophorans kind of very derived or extant Labourpodians because they share this kind of broad body organization. But Labourpodian itself is a misnomer, so it's probably best to use it informally as opposed to, say, extant Labourpodians or that sort of thing.
Right, I got you. So you're saying that calling a velvet worm a Labourpodian is like calling a spider or an insect a creepy crawly. It's not an accurate term, but it's kind of used to group together a big load of animals.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, okay. Sorry. But anyway, how do velvet worms live?
So velvet worms, they're quite remarkable creatures. So they tend to live in tropical rainforests and places where it's humid. They have problems with drying out. So they creep around through leaf litter, burrowing through tree trunks and that sort of thing. And all living velvet worms are predatory. So most of them have got a pair of slime glands on either side of their heads that can squirt adhesive glue at their prey. And once they've ensnared it, they'll go and nip it apart with their little claws.
Oh, wow. Like claws on their limbs or the teeth or?
Yeah, they've got claws on their limbs. And also there's a pair of their legs that through development actually end up inside their mouth cavity. And the claws are sort of modified to be really jaggedy and serrated and adapted basically to serve as jaws. So they're quite weird creatures in many ways.
So if we go back to the fossil record, when was their first appearance?
So we first see Labourpodians in the early Cambrian period, so about 530 million years ago. And the first things we see are isolated spines, essentially, and we see complete fossils of Labourpodians in the Chengjiang and the Burgess Shale deposits, which are exceptionally preserved sites in China and in the Canadian Rockies. That are early to middle Cambrian in age.
There's quite a lot of spines, I would have thought, in the early Cambrian period. You've got trilobites, you've got Wawaxia, for example. How do you know that the spikes are from Labourpodians?
So Lobopodian spikes are quite distinctive, actually. So one thing that they have is a little texture of little triangular scales that covers the whole surface. But there are a few other things that also have a similar surface ornament. The really distinctive thing for Lobopodians, and for Onychophoran-like Lobopodians in particular, is that their spines are made up of a sort of a cone stacked in a cone inside a cone. So it's sort of like a pile of traffic cones almost. And that nested arrangement is very much distinctive of this particular group.
Well, this week has been a very important one for Lobopodians, with a new study being published on hallucigenia by you, Martin. So can you tell us about the hallucigenia? When was it found and where was it found?
So yeah, hallucigenia, I guess, is the iconic Lobopodian. And it's sort of the star, I guess, of Wonderful Life, which sort of Javier and I were both excited by the Burgess Shale when we read this. And so hallucigenia's got a really checkered back history. It was found 100 years ago or so, and the guy who discovered it didn't really know what to do with it. It was first properly described in the 1970s by Simon Conway Morris in Cambridge, who rather unfortunately interpreted the animal upside down. So this seems like a very silly mistake to make, but actually it's quite understandable. So the fossils themselves are pretty weird. Hallucigenia is a centimetre or two long, and on one side of the animal are these really long curved spines. And opposite each pair of spines, Simon Conway Morris saw just a long dangly tentacle type thing. So he thought, well, the spines occur in pairs, so they must be legs. And these dangly tentacles, well, who knows, maybe they're passing food to one end of the body or the other. And because some of the fossils had a big balloon-shaped orb on one end of the animal, he assumed that this was the head. So if you imagine this sort of reconstruction, like some little cigar on stilts with a huge puff of smoke at one end as a head, it's a very bizarre reconstruction, and you know, hence the name hallucigenia, I guess. So it wasn't until much later that related fossils were found in China, and where hallucigenia had one dangly tentacle, these fossils had two tentacles, and where hallucigenia had spines, these guys had flat plates. And the guys working on this thought, well, hang on, this makes a lot more sense if we turn it up. If these aren't tentacles, they're actually legs, and if these spines are some sort of armour along the back. And sure enough, when they revisited these hallucigenia fossils, they went back with a micro-engraving tool, and they chipped away at the mud that had smothered the animal as it was buried, and were able to reveal the second half of this pair of legs. So that got hallucigenia the right way up. But there was still a bit of controversy as to which end was the head and which end was the tail. So that's where our study has sort of come in to resolve this long-standing debate. There have been suggestions, actually, that this blob at one end of the animal was not actually part of the animal at all, but that it represented decay fluids or gut contents that had oozed out of the tail end of the animal as it was compressed during burial. And we were actually able to show, indeed, that the composition of this dark, blobby head thing is different from the composition of the cuticle of the animal. So it's not part of the animal at all. We can throw that out. And we'd be able to find the two legs that actually end the body there. So having worked out that was the tail, we then went back and said, OK, well, does it have a head? Can we find the head? And my co-author Jean Bernard very delicately got this micro-engraving tool and started digging away at the other end of the fossil. It's a really delicate job. The fossil's about the width of a pin, and so he's sort of chipping away and revealing this head. And so we had a few dozen fossils that seemed to show this, but we weren't totally convinced it was the head yet. With a light microscope, we couldn't see any features jumping out particularly, and so we had to put the fossils into electron microscopes, which give us a much higher resolution. And when we did that, we were very excited at what we saw. So we saw not just a pair of eyes along the end of this sort of long neck-like thing, but below the pair of eyes, there's this sort of big smile of teeth sort of grinning back at us out of the microscope almost. So we were able to reconstruct this as part of a ring of teeth that would originally have surrounded the mouth. And weirder still, along the throat of hallucigenia, there's another set of needle-like teeth that sort of point towards the stomach. So we've got this really weird configuration. Not only can we say this is the head, but we can say this is a really bizarre and unusual head.
So Were the new anatomical characteristics that you identified, did that bring it more in line with what you'd expect to see from a stem group lobopodian, stem group onychophoran?
Yes, thank you. Sorry.
Sorry. Javier's just here to correct me.
Did these make it more like a stem group onychophoran? Well, quite the opposite, actually. They were completely unexpected. So modern day onychophorans, if you look at their gut, it's completely simple. There's no teeth or anything going on at all. And in fact, the teeth arrangement that we saw in Hallucigenia is much more similar to what we see in a group of animals called the penis worms. So penis worms are molting animals, they're size of a finger or smaller nowadays. And around their mouth is a little ring of spines. And their throat, they can actually sort of spit out, they can turn it inside out. And their throat is lined with all these little teeth. And so a ring of teeth around the mouth and teeth along the throat, that's very similar to what we saw in Hallucigenia. So we were left sort of scratching our heads and thinking, well, how does this fit together? How come it's got penis worm characteristics? And it's also got some velvet worm characteristics in its claws and its spines. So how do we fit all this together? And what it looks like was going on is that basically Hallucigenia is telling us that the ancestor of all molting animals, so that's the enormous group containing things like penis worms as well as velvet worms and arthropods and various parasitic taxa, this enormous group of molting animals ancestrally had this particular configuration of teeth around the mouth and teeth along the throat. And that's quite a surprising conclusion because this is such a diverse group of taxa that you kind of expect their common ancestor, yeah, they've got very little in common. Their common ancestor, you might think, would be very deep in time and very simple. But actually we're saying there really was some complexity in this common ancestor. And sort of paradoxically, this complexity in the throat has been lost over time on the lineage that leads to the velvet worms, as well as on the lineage that leads up to the arthropods independently. So we've got this sort of picture of evolution simplifying, in some respects, the animals that we saw in the Cambrian period as they get more complicated in other respects.
So, I mean, I'm really glad that Martin brought up the... I mean, they get simplified in some ways, but they get complex in another ones. A really good example of increasing complexity is, for example, in terms of their head organization. Even though their kind of this pharyngeal armature did get reduced independently, you also see that in onychophorans and in arthropods, you have the recruitment of additional segments to form a functional head, which is differentiated from the rest of the body. And this is also that has occurred completely independently in arthropods and in onychophorans. And arthropods actually take it to a big extreme because they continue to add segments into their head until they have this kind of multi-appendicular, highly specialized specialized body region, a tagma, which is largely kind of, it's kind of largely responsible for their staggering diversity and ecological success nowadays.
And I think that's an interesting point to sort of think on. So arthropods and velvet worms as well. We were talking earlier about how they've incorporated some of their legs into their mouth and got claws and involved those in chopping up food. And maybe what we're seeing in both of these lineages is as they're incorporating legs into their heads, they're able to do more complex things. They're able to chop food up and to process foods in ways they weren't before. And so the simple sucking action that would have been possible through the tooth arrangement in Hallucigenia suddenly seems a little bit simplistic and insufficient. And you can imagine how natural selection might recognize the new possibilities that are coming to be through the incorporation of legs that allow the animals to do more complex things. And the sort of teeth in the mouth suddenly become redundant because the food processing can be outsourced to these legs that are now part of the head.
Yeah, most definitely. It's all about, if arthropods have taught us something, is that it's all about the limbs. Because having so many limbs and so highly specialized means that they can do whatever they want. So if there is a niche they can occupy, they will occupy it by making limbs specifically for addressing a particular function.
So bringing it back to the actual animal, Hallucigenia, do we now have to reinterpret its ecology?
Well, getting from morphology to ecology is not as straightforward as we would like it to be, really. So what do we know about it? Well, we can sort of tell from its spines that it was something that things might have liked to eat. These spines presumably were defensive and suggest that Hallucigenia was sitting around in exposed situations on the seafloor or, you know, clambering up various sponges and seaweeds, perhaps. So you can start to speculate, well, Hallucigenia's got these seven pairs of long legs with claws on. Maybe they were suitable for climbing. It's got these three pairs of tentacles coming off its neck that are really, really skinny. And, yeah, was it using those to as antennae to feel around, or was it using them to process food in some way or to gather food? And then what was Hallucigenia eating, I guess, is another question. And its mouth parts seem adapted for sort of sucking stuff up. Nothing much more complicated than that. So maybe it was crawling around the seafloor, sort of hoovering food from the surface. Maybe it was clinging to sponges and sucking little bits out of the sponge and feeding on those. So, got a lot of speculation, but we can sort of say some things that it wasn't doing. You know, it wasn't going around chopping food up. It wasn't a terrifying predator. So we're narrowing it down, but it would still be nice to know a lot more about what Hallucigenia was doing.
Well, I mean, interestingly, kind of bringing up the possible sucking kind of function of the head and the mouth parts, it has been suggested that in kind of berry-derived forms like animal acaridids, the mouth parts, which are quite similar to those of Hallucigenia, may also have had a sucking motion. Before, animal acaridids were considered to be kind of these trilobite muncher predators, but actually their mouth parts are not biomineralized as opposed to a trilobite exoskeleton. So it would be really hard to go and use mouth parts that have a consistency of a toenail and try to dig into a trilobite. So an alternative interpretation is that they were actually kind of sucking stuff out. They would use these rake-like appendages to kind of sieve out worms like Otoya, and then just kind of like, well, suck it for feeding. And if that is the case, this is something which is also shared kind of, well, probably deep down into the base of Panarthropoda, like an ancestral kind of sucking mechanism of feeding. I don't know. What do you think, Martin?
Yeah, no, I think it certainly makes sense that the last ancestor of all molting animals had this sort of sucking device. And this ring of teeth that we see in Hallucigenia, we see in Anomalocaris, seems to work particularly well in a sucking format. And indeed, the tardigrades, the water bears that are still alive today, have got a similar arrangement of their mouth parts, and they seem to be using that to generate suction as well. So, yeah, it's quite nice to think that we might have an idea of what the last common ancestor of this enormous group was doing, how it was feeding.
So there you go, Dave. You have your tagline, Ecdysozoans suck.
Yeah, you know what? I was thinking about a pun, but I thought better of it. So I'm glad that you did it. Right, Hallucigenia isn't the only lobopodium from the Burgess Shale, though. Can you tell us about Collins' monster?
Yeah, definitely. Apart from Hallucigenia and the Collins monster, there are also other ones like, for example, Aishaea, but I mean, that's another issue. So the Collins monster is this kind of interesting kind of curiosity in that it's a nickname to begin with for a specific fossil that has been known since the 80s, but that to this day has not been described, probably because, well, these type of fossils are really, really hard to come by. And I mean, as far as you understand, there is ongoing work in the Royal Ontario Museum kind of describing this animal, which is going to be extremely exciting. But the thing is, so I mean, the whole story behind the Collins monster is that it was discovered in the 80s by an Australian paleontologist called Desmond Collins when he was at the Royal Ontario Museum. And he was, for a long time, he went to the Burgess Shale localities to do expeditions and do diggings. And one of the kind of arguably weirdest things he found was this kind of Collins monster thing. And the Collins monster, I mean, it's hard to describe because it just looks a little bit all over the place. It's a little bit like a furry caterpillar that has these long arms on the front with spines and has spines on its back. And it's kind of like a little bit short-bodied. And at the time, he only presented this in a single publication, in an outreach publication. And he didn't name it or describe it proper. He just said, well, what is this? We have no idea. This is so different to anything we know. So it was kind of put aside until more material came available. However, I mean, early on, it was really hard to actually pin out any affinities with any other animal, either extinct or extant. But with the discovery of this kind of additional lobopodian taxa from the Chenggang in China, it was possible to actually make some more comparisons. For example, there's a taxon called Luolichenia, which is actually a close relative to the Collins monster. So the same team of workers that kind of put Halcyonia upside, the right way up, also had this discussion that, actually the Collins monster is weird, but I mean, we can identify it as a very, very spiny lobopodian. And so it goes. So at the moment, the word is that the Collins monster is actually one of these kind of, it's a highly specialized lobopodian, although it has yet to be formally described.
Have they still only got one specimen?
No, as far as I'm aware of, there is a lot more material now. But yeah, that's all I know.
And how come it's not been described? Is it, I mean, as soon as the Chinese group realized that it was a spiny lobopodian, wouldn't everyone just jump on it and say, here it is, spiny lobopodian?
I am not very sure, to be honest. I mean, I guess it has to deal with different people working at different times in the collections, maybe just waiting to make this like a better study by having more material available. And I mean, as I mentioned before, these type of fossils are really, really hardy to come by. So they are not common by any stretch of the imagination. They're mostly soft-bodied. And even in the Burgess shell, I mean, it can be hard to find such delicate creatures. Luck prevented it in a way from being described earlier.
And so you've got the Collins monster, you've got Aishaya, was it?
Aishaya is another lobopodium from the Burgess shell.
And Hallucigenia, all in the Burgess shell together.
Yes.
So I guess there's quite a diversity of lobopodians at that time.
That is true. Here in the Burgess shell, we're in the Middle Cambrian. However, the main diversity of lobopodians actually comes from the early Cambrian in China. Several lobopodian species have been described from the Chenggang, and to a good extent also from the Sirius Passet in North Greenland. We have all these localities, and all of them have their own almost endemic diversity of lobopodians. Halucidinia may be an exception. It's the only one that appears to occur in a more widely distributed fashion at the level of a genus. There seems to be quite a bit of endemicity going on over here.
So if we go to China now, we've actually got a new lobopod being described today on a release day of this podcast, and that is Collinsium ciliosum, and that's from the Xiaoshiba largestetter. So can you tell us about this new lobopodium, please?
Yeah, most definitely. As you mentioned, this comes from the Xiaoshiba Lagerstätten, which is slightly younger than the Chenggang. So that would put it in approximately 518, 515, something like that, a million years. This is a locality that has been only, it was relatively recently discovered, and it's been worked on for the last 5 years or so. By colleagues at Yunnan University in Kunming in South China. This new animal, Collinsium, is really one of the most impressive things that have come out so far. As you will notice, it actually resembles Halucidinia a lot. It's a lobopodian, so it's a worm-like animal with legs, and it has spines on its back, and it has a bulbous head. In an interesting way, Collinsium is a little bit like Halucidinia, kind of like on caffeine or like on Red Bull or something like that. So Halucidinia has one pair of spines per pair of legs. In the case of Collinsium, it has up to five spines per set of legs. So it's a lot more spiny. And then also it has this very strongly marked differentiation of its legs. It has a tiny pair of antenna on the front of the head, which was likely used for sensing its environment. But then it has these really, really long and elegant limbs, which are almost feather-like in their construction because they have these delicate spines coming out at either side. And this is followed by nine pairs of more conventional-looking lobopodous limbs that terminate in a single strong claw. We can clearly see that there is an evolutionary relationship between these organisms, but Collinsium has truly gone kind of undone a little bit of evolution by itself, and it's become highly specialized in terms of its ecology and adaptations.
You mentioned about the differentiation of the limbs, and before we were talking about how important that is for arthropods. So what were each of the appendages, each of the limbs doing in Collinsium?
Sure. So as we were mentioning, these short and thin form appendages, which is the first pair of limbs, it was probably used for sensing. The really interesting part is these six pairs of feathery elongate limbs. Our interpretation of the animal is that these limbs were highly specialized for feeding. So our reconstruction of its ecology is that it would probably not walk on the seafloor because it would be muddy and not very stable. So it would use its kind of really, really heavy claws to kind of cling onto something, as Martin was saying earlier on, about maybe sponges or rocks or seaweeds or anything that would actually take it above the water-substrate interface where it is not muddy, and just kind of get a little bit closer to the freshwater, to the water column. From this position, it would anchor with its nine pairs of clawed legs, and then it would make this kind of very delicate motion, almost like waving or hugging the water, to entrap nutrients or small organisms into a feeding basket. If you can imagine all these feathery limbs coming together at the same time, they would make this kind of sieve that would filter smaller particles. And then using this interpretation that this type of lobopodians likely used a sucking motion for feeding, it is very likely that the feeding basket was then consumed by this kind of sucking motion with the mouth. Something interesting is that both Hallucigenia and Collinsium and several other close-related lobopodians have a downwards-facing mouth. So it seems quite sensible to interpret that this is actually a functional thing. If it's going to actually bring stuff together, foodstuff together near to its body, it has to have its mouth in the right position. So it's a little bit like a straw, if you can just picture it, just kind of making this sucking motion with a flexible neck.
And do any other modern animals kind of have this ecology, this feeding strategy?
There are several animals that do filter feeding for a living, but it can be quite different. For example, many crustaceans rely on filter feeding, but they use this battery of very specialized limbs, as we're talking about, to produce a feeding current. However, they don't necessarily have to stay put in a certain place. I recently found out about a group of shrimp called bamboo shrimp that in a way have similar feathery or fan-like anterior limbs, and they seem to do a similar motion. In this case, again, the shrimp do not need to stay attached to a particular spot. What is interesting about Collinsium is that this is by all means a soft-bodied animal. It completely lacks any articulated joints or anything like that, so it would probably not have a lot of very precise muscle control. So we interpret that this would probably be a very slow, delicate movement. So in that way, there is nothing which is completely soft-bodied and that moves around that can actually produce the same type of feeding.
Okay, and if we're saying that it would attach itself to other organisms, do we find an association of the Collinsium fossils, say, like, still attached to sponges?
Unfortunately, we have not found such association with Collinsium specifically. One of the issues is that the Ceauchiva biota as a whole is still in early stages of being described. So all the more delicate aspects of finding correlations between different organisms in the same slab I mean, that's work that still has to be done. And, well, kind of interestingly, there seems to be a sort of lack of sessile organisms going around. I mean, I cannot talk too much about it because it's still work in progress. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, we have not seen this association with this specific fossil so far. However, it has been suggested based on other localities and other lobopodians that there may have been this association with sponges. For example, this Aishai animal we were talking about from the Burgess Shell has been found to have sponge spicules in its gut, or at least in its body cavity, which led to the suggestion that maybe they were clinging on sponges and feeding on them. Also, if we go back to China in the Chengyang, there are some forms, I believe Pausipodia, or yeah, I think it's one of those, which is, again, it's a little bit like Hallucigenia, but without the spines. It's just kind of like worm with legs, and there is not too much about it. But this has been found in association with some kind of enigmatic animals called Eldeonids, which are, they look a little bit like jellyfish, but they may be closer to sea cucumbers. But I mean, that's another point. So, I mean, there is a little bit of association in some cases, but nothing very, very strong as to be able to say, oh, yes, this is definitely the life cell and there is no change to it. There is, it's a working hypothesis as far as we know.
If we take Collinsium and compare it to Hallucigenia, and especially the things that Martin's just found out about Hallucigenia, mm-hmm. You mentioned that Collinsium has a bulbous head. Could it be possible that you've got it back to front and this bulbous head actually represents the fluids being squished out the back?
We're pretty confident that we have it the right way up and front to back. The reason being is that we have a big population. It's almost 30 specimens, and many of them are actually completely articulated and well preserved. So there is a very clear anterior-posterior orientation of the animal. For example, we have also that these feeding limbs, the six pairs of feeding limbs, are only found on the anterior part of the animal by comparison with other lobopodians. So, yeah, I mean, and there is, I mean, again, the bulbous head, in the case of Hallucigenia, one of the problem was that, I mean, you really, really needed to have an SEM to be able to identify the different composition between the cuticle and the decay fluids. In the case of the Shioshiba biota, well, it has a slightly different type of preservation. Because of weathering, the fossils actually stand out a little bit more from the matrix in terms of their color and their convexity. Chengyan type preservation is a little bit more three-dimensional than the Burgess Shell type. So because of these reasons and the presence of other kind of aspects of the morphology, for example, a pair of isolated sclerites on the front of the animal, we're pretty confident that we have it the right way up. Finally, we also have very good preservation of the gut, which is just a straight tube of the digestive system. And we can see exactly where the mouth comes out. So there is no controversy about that. Unfortunately, we don't have quite the level of detail that we see in Hallucigenia, in that we can see like the mouth parts or pharyngeal teeth. But that doesn't mean that they're not necessarily there.
Why was Collinsium so well armored?
So we have made this observation that in all these kind of Collins monster type lobopodians, that there is this correlation between having these specialized feeding limbs and also having this kind of more developed dorsal armature of spines. We think that according to the reconstruction of its ecology, if it indeed actually clawed into something high above in the water column and then was feeding using this kind of very unique mode of putting nutrients in its mouth, then it would have been exposed to predators, as kind of Martin was saying a little bit earlier on about Hallucigenia. This would be a lot more dramatic because, I mean, if you have to filter feed, you probably have to spend a good chunk of time doing it because it's not exactly a highly nutrient time effort valuable option. And if this was the case, the only way to avoid being eaten would be to actually use the only spines you have and just multiply them around the body. So Collinsium had 72 individual spines of various lengths and curvatures throughout the body. So having this increased armor would actually prevent it from being eaten, or at least being kind of harassed around by something like an Anomalocaris or some other predator back in the day. So yeah, I mean, there's kind of like this intricate relationship between building a heavier armament, but also to compensate for a very specialized mode of feeding.
So what is the significance of Kalynzium? Is it the same as Hallucigenia in that it tells us about the basal condition of the Ecdysozoa?
In the case of Kalynzium, the story of its significance is a little bit different. In this case, so Kalynzium represents the best preserved species of a small group which are collectively known as Lulichaenids, or informally Collins monster type Lobopodians. They'll have a similar body construction. They have more than like three or more spines per appendage pair. They all have these feathery limbs. And they have kind of posterior clawed appendages. They make this very, very well-defined small group. Now, what is interesting about Collins monster type Lobopodians is that they actually are not necessarily very ancestral on their own merit. They are actually quite derived within the Onychophorum stem group. They are what we would call a plesion, which is a monophyletic group that has no living representatives. You can think about it in terms of, for example, birds and dinosaurs. Like the dinosaurs, which are not directly in the line of birds. They are a clade, but they have no living representatives. So it's a very similar situation. So when we put this into kind of like the bigger picture, one of the things we did was to quantify the degree of complexity of the limbs using a tagmosis index. And it happens that actually Lulichaenids collectively, and as far as we know, Kalynzium specifically, have the highest degrees of limb complexity in any Lobopodian during the Paleozoic, which is quite remarkable. So this is saying, well, there was actually quite a bit of a specialization going on in terms of form and function. Now, when we make the comparison with their extant relatives, the velvet worms, this is quite interesting, because then the story is that early during their evolutionary history, during the Cambrian, the lineage that would eventually result in velvet worms had very, very, very high disparity. Now, disparity means that you have variation in terms of morphology. Now, the situation is that extant velvet worms have very, very low disparity. They're really cute, and they do kind of this extremely interesting ecology in like the slime shooting and hunting, but they're all the same. Velvet worms have 180 species, and pretty much, I mean, if you see one, you have seen all of them, with the exception of the number of legs and different patterns of coloration. So ultimately, what Kalynzium, Lulichaenids, and all these other Lobopodians in the stem group of Onychophora are telling us is that the group had a bottom-heavy disparity. This is a major evolutionary pattern that has been observed in some other animals, for example, the sea lilies or crinoids, and also in the brachiopods, in which they were very diverse and disparate back in the day, but nowadays they are restricted to marginal environments. However, this is the first time that we can recognize this pattern for an entirely or almost entirely soft-bodied group such as the Onychophorans. So in that regard, it's kind of providing a slightly, it's illuminating a slightly different aspect of their evolutionary history.
Do you think that lobopods get the attention that they really deserve?
Lobopodians have been recognized as being quite significant in the last years. There has been a bit of a resurgence, but also it's a matter of having the fossils available. Because, I mean, that is obviously a big limiting factor. If more people want to study Lobopodians, it would be fantastic. The problem is that there are not that very many Lobopodians to work on. It's heavily dependent on finding new fossils, new localities. And even then, it can be well, it can take time to actually produce enough, a collection big enough to make justice to each individual species. By all means, there's also other ways of addressing this question. There hasn't been much done in terms of, for example, their ontogeny.
How they develop from a juvenile to an adult.
Yes, correct. Lobopodians remain as kind of really fascinating and slightly enigmatic animals, and it will be until there is more material available that we can start to address some of the more contentious aspects of their evolution.
Well, Martin, Javier, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
No problem.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.